Hi, do you want to introduce yourselves and tell us where we are today?
Yeah, hi, I'm Richard Proger. We're here at Active Web Solutions. I'm Technical Director. We're based in Ipswich, just outside London in the UK.
And I'm Neil Kidd. I'm an architect inside the Microsoft Technology Centre in Thames Valley Park in the UK.
So we're here to talk about some work you've been doing with Windows Azure. Do you want to explain what the application is you've been working on and how it works for us?
Yeah, sure. We've been working on an application that's called MOB Guardian. It's essentially a search and rescue application that's been designed for the UK and Irish Search and Rescue Services, the RNOI. And the system's primarily designed to help save the lives of fishermen at sea.
And what sort of technology is involved in that? How does it do that? How does it work?
Okay, well, it's a satellite-based tracking monitoring system. A piece of electronics gets installed on a fishing boat, and fisherman wears a small wireless personal safety device which communicates with the base unit on the boat. And if the guy falls off the boat into the water, then the signal is broken, and then an alert message is sent via satellite directly into the search and rescue service. I'll draw you a picture if it helps. So you're out here in the sea somewhere, you've got a fishing boat, and that sends a signal up to a satellite. And we're using the Iridium satellite constellation, and there's about 40 or so of those satellites in orbit, and they're polar orbiting, so we get total global coverage. So the guy falls in the water here, waving his arms, the message gets sent, and it comes down to the ground station, which is in Tempe in the US, and then it comes across the pond to our data centre. In fact, we have two data centres for resilience. Then we have a cluster of servers there that process those messages, and then they relay those messages on to search and rescue services, which in the UK is the Royal National Lifeboat Institution, and they have a smart client application that's a thick client deployed to them via ClickOnce technology, and that talks essentially to the back end servers over just standard XML web services, a SOAP interface. So an alarm gets raised on the UI here, and then what the RMI then do is they then transfer that alarm to the UK Coast Guard headquarters, which is down on the south coast. And in the UK, it's the Coast Guard that are responsible for initiating search and rescue. So they'll then decide what's the best type of asset to mobilise, whether that's a helicopter or a lifeboat. And then they can, through automated mechanisms, dispatch a lifeboat. But there are two other modes of operation of this thing. You've got the capability of detecting the man overboard in the first instance. But also, in the UK, we lose about 20 or 30... fishermen every year just disappear, and no one knows whatever happened to them. So one of the things that this system does as well is the box of electronics reports the position of the boat while it's fishing normally at regular intervals and sends it up. So we're also listening for missed messages as well. So if we detect that, we also raise what's called a vessel overdue alarm. And then what the system does through the front end gives you a marine chart, electronic version of a marine chart that's delivered through a virtual earth interface and shows them the last known position of that boat. So that's kind of how it works. As I said, we've got another data centre in here, and we distribute and we have real-time sort of data replication between the two and that sort of thing. But what's interesting about this system is that compared to other systems of this type that have some of the similar features, we're the only one that has a direct linkage right through to search and rescue services. And also, we've got the ability to do this vessel overdue monitoring, which other systems can't do. And we can also send messages back the other way, too. So that's kind of...
So this system's live today.
Yep.
And I suppose looking at that description of it, one of the things that's obvious is the more vessels you have out there, the more messages you're...
Yeah,
system
absolutely.
Needs to deal with. So I suppose that leads us on to the work you've been doing with Windows Azure,
mm-hmm.
and maybe you can just give us a high-level overview of what you've been doing there.
Yeah, I think you're right about the scalability. I mean, we realised that whilst the system was initially designed for the UK fishing fleet, which was what the principal problem was from the RNI's perspective, that fishing fleet is about 6,000 or so vessels. So even if we were to sell these units, or give these units to every single fisherman, we'd still be well within the capacity of what we have right now. But that's only a very small market. We knew that this system was just as applicable to the leisure marine market in the UK, which is 500,000 or more boats, and the fishing industries and the leisure marine industries worldwide. The satellite system, as I explained, covers the whole world, so there's no reason why we can't take this further afield. So our system, which is designed to 10,000, when we want to go to the next 10,000, we have to do it in sort of large chunks. So we have to, when we get customer 10,001 on board, we have to replicate all the infrastructure we have to cope with that extra volume. What Windows Azure and all the cloud services piece can offer us is the potential to grow that based on demand and on the numbers of customers, almost on an individual basis, if you like. We can turn up the wick on that, turn the power up, the number of instances of services and things we have based on the demand.
So what have you done with your system in Windows Azure? What have you been working on for the last few weeks?
Well, back to the board, essentially what we wanted to do was we wanted to keep the front-end application, the UI piece is exactly the same, and then the back-end, or the actual delivery of the message is the same. We don't have any ability to influence that significantly. But what we wanted to do is we wanted to take the functionality that we had here in the data centre and move that into Windows Azure. That's what we wanted to do, because what that would allow us to do was, rather than when we get customer 10,001 on board, create another data centre, we actually wanted to take the functionality that was in there and then just go onto a web portal somewhere and press a button and say, please provision me all the additional services that I now need to support this additional set of customers. So we've been taking our existing code base that we had and migrating that to run in Windows Azure.
So through that process, have you found that easy, difficult, lots of problems? What were the challenges? What were the hardest things to deal with?
Well, when we sat down there, didn't we, and we talked about what were the potential different architectures for doing this, we came up with two potential approaches that I think that we could take. The first was to take almost everything that we currently had and just migrate the underlying data elements to talk to the Windows Azure storage components and take the Windows services as they were running on the existing servers and migrate those as processes within Windows Azure and the web services as well. So that was one thing. And then the second thing we did, we decided to investigate was, well, what if we started with a clean sheet of paper? What would we do then? Would we architect the application differently? Obviously, we didn't. We weren't aware that these technologies were emerging when we first started this project. But interestingly enough, what we discovered, I think, more than anything else, was that, certainly from my perspective, was that if you're already using established techniques for developing applications of this type, using web services, a service-oriented architecture, you've got some back-end processes running in Windows services, it's very easy to wrap those, take out the bits that don't apply and wrap those and put those into Windows Azure without any major challenges.
Yeah, I think we're both quite surprised about that, weren't we?
Yeah.
On the grounds that your web interface you've got at the moment is as a ransom, ASP.NET web service.
Yeah.
Some of the things you're returning are data sets and type data sets, and we weren't quite sure how that's going to work when we move over into the Azure world. The code just worked. It just compiled up. We don't think we had to make any changes to it. To be able to replicate that service running on Azure as opposed to running on our own hosted or our own managed server.
Yeah.
So what were the areas where you sort of had to... I mean, it's not just I take my code, put it in, and it runs. What were the areas that you had to sort of almost go back to the drawing board and start again? You almost have to forget what you already know and start from a different perspective.
So as Richard mentioned, we kind of went with two approaches. One, to kind of take the existing code base and port that pretty much directly onto Azure. We also then did a direct port of the back-end SQL Server database and put that into SQL Server data services. We knew at the time we were doing this, it was kind of a lower risk strategy, and the application was already worked. But we're accepting the same limitations on the scalability of the size of the application. So using the same kind of scheme, the same data access controls. When we went for the how would we architect this in the cloud version, that's kind of where we hit. Well, it's not trouble, but that's where we think about things differently, in that the data is the big big problem if you want to be able to move over to into Azure. The most obvious thing there is the fact that there's no transactions. So moving any transactional system into a system that doesn't involve transactions involves working in a very different way with your data and how you integrate with that system.
That's a good point, actually, because you know we have some quite tight service level agreements imposed upon us by our customer here, and because of being a safety of life system, we've got to make sure that we don't drop the ball at any particular point. So the existing application using a SQL Server database, an awful lot of transactions there. As soon as a message comes in, we take that transaction, you write that to the database like a hot potato, and then other processes come along and look at that and process that as an alarm or whatever the case may be, and that has to be transactional, because one of the things they say in our service level agreement is we must never lose a message, right? So that's quite a fundamental thing. So it was a different kind of mindset here. What we decided was we had to have a mechanism that allowed us to provide the same level of resilience and reliability, if you like, without the transactions. So it was a different approach. We had to make sure that every time we were writing any of the taking messages off queues and writing them into tables, that was idempotent, so we didn't have it didn't side effect anything. It didn't matter how many times we did it, and if we failed to read the queue correctly or we half wrote it, the next time it came along, that wouldn't actually impact the system. So there's a little bit of thinking about it a bit differently to what we'd done previously.
So the approach you've used is fundamentally based around queues.
Yeah.
Is that, do you think that's a generic approach? Can you expand on what you did and how that...
I think this is going to be one of the fundamental ways of working with Azure. One of the properties we've got about the queuing system in that platform is that if you take a message off the queue and within a certain amount of, which is configurable, a certain amount of time you haven't told the queuing system that you've correctly processed that message will effectively come back to life, will appear at the top of the queue, and what you've got sitting reading the queue will be able to process it again. So this is kind of this is the way we can actually recover from any errors that occur. We know that if we do throw an exception or something goes wrong whilst we're processing one of these messages, we know we've not lost it, we know it will come back to life on the queue, and we just need to make sure we set those timeouts to being a sensible interval. And what that means is, certainly the way I started thinking about the system is that that unit of work that's executing is grounded by that queue. It's kind of like an electrical term in that your OS, you're safe, as long as you're still attached to that queue. Once you've told the queuing system that you've finished processing with that message, then you're kind of, you're on your own.
You've got commit.
Exactly, yeah. You've got no safety net. But what that does mean is that because messages can come back to life after a certain amount of time, you now have no in-order delivery of messages, because although they may arrive in our system in order, if we have a problem, then we'll start to we process them out of order. And we may have to process messages multiple times. So it could well be that we actually succeeded in actually processing the message, but haven't been able to tell the queue, but then the time actually comes back to life again. So our processing mechanisms have to be re-entrant. If we write something into a table, if we have to write it in again, we can't fail in that instance. So it has to be that re-entrant method. So as long as we're re-entrant and we're using the queues to ground ourselves, we found it relatively straightforward to make sure our system is reliable and robust.
So transactions is one thing. What about querying of data? It seems to me that there isn't the richness of query support that maybe most people would be used to over the last maybe 15, 20 years. Really.
Yeah, the best way to, I heard it summed up recently, was that we're now in the state of the transaction hangover, in that we've had transactions for the last 15 years, and now we're kind of hungover, so we're starting to come down from that. So, it's tricky. You do need to think very much about how your application is is going to be reliable. But then also from the querying side of things, it moves where you do the complexity for your operations. So if you think about the SQL Server world, you'll probably do a complicated insert, so that you potentially write to multiple tables, all of those maintain you've got integrity across all those different tables as part of your transaction as the data goes in. As you pull information back again, you've got the complexity in the query as well, as you join that data back together again and look up tables, etc. But inside the Azure storage model for the table storage, you don't have that rich, complicated querying engine. There's no concepts of joins, and the actual queries you can do are very limited as well. So we end up working on the premise that storage is very cheap, so why not effectively pre-create all our queries? So we store data in multiple tables, effectively in multiple places and multiple tables. So what we end up doing, our queries just become effectively a select star from a partitioned table, and those obviously will come back very quickly.
So effectively, you're pre-creating the answers to questions that you know you're going to have to ask at some point in the future.
Pretty much, and this is not kind of we're in the fortunate position where we're not doing incredibly complicated reporting, and the model we use probably is going to be applicable for that. But in certain cases, so when we create an incident and the man's gone in the water or the vessel's overdue, we'll write to about three or four different tables.
Yeah.
The same data, the position report, the identification of the boat, will go into that as effectively pre-canned queries.
It was interesting how what the difference was. Neil was talking earlier about the first cut we did, we were using SSDS, and that has a much richer querying capability compared to what you can do in the Azure table storage. Not as rich as you can do with full-blown SQL Server, of course, but much richer. And that actually made it very easy for us just to put the data in and get it back out again. It was only when we had to go to the Azure table storage that we had to kind of denormalize everything and say, well, we're going to have a set of one table for each of the kind of queries that our front-end web services are actually going to call. So it was a bit of a change of mindset there in some ways. But once you get into that, it actually becomes quite simple to follow actually a lot easier, I think, because you know, like, these are the results I want, therefore I'm going to put them there, rather than have to come at it from the other way thinking, here's all my data, how do I get my query out of it?
That there are two kind of, there's two things you've got which you've got control over. This, you've got your partition key and you've got your row key, and they're pretty much the only things you're going to be able to query on. If you query on anything that isn't the partition key or the row key, then you're going to effectively invoke a table scan. You're going to have to go through all the records in that table or inside in that partition to be able to identify what it is you're looking for. So the partition key, basically, if you think of it analogous to the name of the machine, the instance of that storage server that data is stored in, shows how you can actually start to scale your application out to be out massive volumes. So if you can store your data from lots of different partitions, they're all running on different machines, you don't have very, very... you're capable of taking very high numbers of read requests per second or writes and queries, etc., rather than following them all through the same database. Mm-hmm. The row key is effectively, think of it like a clustered index inside SQL Server, so that your data is stored in a sorted order and you can query very quickly into that clustered index. Anything else isn't indexed, so if you query against it, you've got to do a complete table scan to actually be able to find that information. So that's one of the ways you decide how you're going to cut your data, is by what sensible row key can you use. And a lot of the stuff that we've been working on is timestamps, so when we get messages from the boat or when events occur. So what we've been doing is turning the timestamp into something we can use as our row key by looking at the ticks property on the date time object, which just gives it down to as to 100 nanosecond granularity, which is pretty good for or certainly good enough for what we were using. And then just turning that into a string and padding it with as many zeros as we felt were necessary. So now if we use that as our row key, we're in sorted order in that table, and if you say, I want the last message that came through, depending on whether you've got it set up as ascending or descending on that value we're generating on the tick cap, we can just take the top item off the row, or if we want the last five items that occurred, then they're all stored in that sort of in time order. Mm.
So did you find, as you sort of took that sort of design and made it real, create code, did you find any of those sort of common approaches manifest as patterns or idioms or any of those things that were both reusable for you but potentially would be useful to other people building apps in this space?
Very much so. I mean, I think the turning the timestamp into something we can use as a row key is very useful, or being able to turn your timestamp into something you could, rather than being an individual value, potentially turn it into a bucket of time, so you could create a partition key based on a timestamp, and being able to put those backs and forwards has been quite useful. One of the biggest patterns I think we spotted was around the ability to do an upsert. So if the item doesn't exist in the table, then you have to insert it. If it does exist, then you need to be able to update it with the data, providing your data isn't older than the data that's already in there. So we can't make any assumptions because we can't rely on guaranteed order delivery of our messages. So we effectively have to do, and there's no upsert supported natively by the API. So we have to do a query to see if the item exists. If it doesn't exist, then we do an insert. And we can catch to see whether that insert failed, because in between our original query and our insert, someone else may have inserted it. So we have to catch that to see whether it succeeds or fails. If it fails, then because the item already exists, then we're now in the position of having to do an update. But the potential exists is that in between us doing that failed insert and an update, someone may have deleted it. So we end up having to write a loop where we keep going around a configurable number of times, either inserting or updating, until we get success or we run out of retries.
There were several other kinds of patterns and things that kind of started to emerge as we refactored the code going through those processes. I think one of the key ones that we came up with was when your code is running in an Azure process somewhere, it's in that sandbox and it's quite difficult to see it from the outside world. The only way to communicate into a process is to communicate to a queue which you're putting stuff into. So we needed to come up with a sensible mechanism for the instrumentation of the code that was actually running in there. And we came up with quite an elegant way, I think, of being able to extract information out of that, write that to another table, which we could then query through the normal mechanisms. That was one key thing. I think the other key thing that emerged was that in our particular case, because the existing application had four or five core Windows services that were processing the message, doing various different things at different times, we wanted to replicate that kind of capability, so we ended up with four or five Azure processors, but we didn't necessarily want to have to instance each of those separately on separate VMs in the cloud. We wanted to run those, potentially to start with, if we had one customer or 10 customers, on one instance. So one of the guys came up with a really elegant configurable mechanism for spawning these sub-processes, if you like, in a multi-threaded environment in one process, and then be able to monitor and manage that in a configurable way. Is that a sensible explanation for that? But it makes it a lot easier. Now we can say, okay, well, if we're having very heavy demand on this particular process, we can just allocate three threads to that. So we'll have three separate ones running, and because they're all separate and they don't interfere with one another, then we can grow the capability until we run out of CPU cycles on that VM, and then we can instance another one and then distribute it.
So it means you have to run a separate worker process in a separate virtual machine instance just for something that's going to happen maybe once an hour or
that's right
once every half hour.
That's right. That's right.
It's around as well as being able to scale out. Can we scale down?
Yes.
What's the minimum footprint of the application?
Yeah.
And we've
got what's the minimum footprint of the application?
Well, one machine.
One machine right now. I mean, it's difficult to predict what the final platform capability will be for any given process. But we have some hard limits on what our systems currently scale to, so we know what we have to achieve. But when you're running on a development environment on a local laptop, you're not going to quite get the same performance that Neil was talking about when it's actually deployed in the real data centres. But we don't foresee that as being a problem at all.
So, having done this sort of re-architecture and taking that and running it inside a Windows Azure, does that now mean that it can't run on Windows Server and SQL Server?
Yeah, nice question. So that was one of the other things we wanted to look at doing, is that because obviously the AWS system is a safety of life system, it's important to make sure that that it is reliable and robust. And at the moment, it runs live in two different data centers, so that if there is a problem with one of those data centers, the operators can just fail over onto the other client.
Yeah.
So what we're looking at, rather than replacing both of those data centers straight away with an Azure-based service, is making Azure one of those data centers and then being able to do away with one of the data centers. What that meant is we didn't want to end up with two different versions of the code base, one to run in the cloud and one to run this on-premise data center. So we architected the second version of the application so it would run in the cloud or it would run in the data center. And for the most part, that kind of made no odds to us whether we're running in the data center or we're running in the cloud, because it's just .NET web services we're executing. But the kind of alluded to earlier on, the tricky bit is around the data side of things. So I think that what we ended up doing was once we worked out how to do it, we were able to move our abstraction layer up, or our data access layer. So rather than being kind of abstracted at the provider model, so you'd have like an iCommand interface or something else that implements iConnection, and whether if you were writing your application to work against SQL Server or another database that's got an AWS.NET data provider for it, we moved it up a level so it was more around the business level. So at this point we're talking about creating incidents or raising alarms or writing position reports. So we created an interface around that. And I'm going to come around and have a look. I've got some code I can probably show you this. So for our incident data access, we just created ourselves an interface that implements the methods that we're going to be ended up using against our storage. And then we have implementation of that interface for SQL Server that, the top one of those isn't implemented yet. But if we look at this one, what we're looking at is SQL connections. Some of these are using transactions, using the facilities that are available to us. These are actually calling into some store procedures, using the facilities that SQL Server offers to us, and the best way of doing development on that platform. Whereas we look at what's the Red Dog one, so it's inside our Red Dog data access area. Then if we scroll down here, then we're putting link queries together that using the Astoria client to make a call into I've been talking about Red Dog, that was its code name, inside the Azure table storage engine. So by being able to do that, we can have a runtime configuration that determines which of those data access layers to load up and decides whether it should be talking to Azure service or to SQL Server. And then the rest of the code base remains the same.
So Astoria then is AWS.NET data services.
Yes.
So what sort of surprised you on working on this project? What happened and you... I suppose if you going into this, you probably had a bunch of preconceptions about how it was going to go, what was going to be difficult, what maybe wasn't going to be difficult, and then at the end of it, after 3 or 4 weeks, however long it was, you'll have a set of experiences. What surprised you from what you thought was going to happen to what really happened?
I mean, from a personal perspective, what surprised me more than anything else was the speed with which we were able to get an end-to-end working prototype up and running. We had set ourselves a target of 3 weeks to build two prototypes, and I wasn't sceptical, but I was concerned perhaps that whether we would even achieve our first objective of getting the existing code base running in the cloud in that time. It actually turned out that once we got the team hooked up and everybody was on messages to exactly what it was we were doing, we did the first port in 2.5 days.
Yeah.
Which blew my mind completely. The second part, I think, probably was about 5 or 6 days actual coding to get us started from a clean sheet of paper.
We spent about 2 days designing it.
Yeah.
And then about 5 or 6 days coding it.
Yeah.
Because one of our stretch goals was going to be the implementation of the SQL Server solution.
Yes.
But we still managed to achieve that as well,
yeah,
to prove that it really,
yeah,
did work.
I think the key to that really for me was... the fact that the APIs and the fact it's all .NET, it's all the APIs are the same. We talked about ADO.NET data services and so on and so forth. there's nothing, no new paradigms to learn there. There's not some strange, bizarre new language we have to understand or ways of doing things. It's very, very familiar to anybody that's done, you know, service-oriented architecture on the Microsoft platform before, and knows how to write half decent .NET code. Then it's not a paradigm shift.
Yeah, I think the thing that brought that home to me was the fact that the service contract uses data sets, and mentally I tie data sets against using SQL command objects and just populating them directly from SQL Server.
So you didn't think this was going to work?
I thought we might have been sunk before we started. just on the grounds that we didn't want to make any changes whatsoever to the client application, so we had to keep that same service contract. But data sets just worked fine. We had to manually instantiate it and populate it ourselves, but data set types fully supported. And it's just the fact that that brought it home to me that I really am writing code against .NET framework here. Mm. Admittedly, there is some stuff around, as long as your code's partial trust, it's probably going to work. So if you're using any com interop or any p-invoke, you're going to have some problems. But other than that, which I suspect most people are not going to be in that situation, it really is just, an environment you're very familiar with.
Yeah, I mean, I think the only things we really had to take out of some of the existing code were things like writing to the event log, which obviously you can't do inside your Azure process. But there are other logging mechanisms, and we actually extended some of those ourselves to provide a bit more instrumentation. I think Neil will talk a bit more about the visualization of that in a minute. But we were actually taking stuff out rather than having to put extra stuff in, which is interesting.
So you've been extending the ability to log data or to visualise that?
Yeah, so this is more kind of from a development effort, in that the way our application works is when the message arrives, it gets put on the incoming message queue, gets pulled off there, and it gets minimally parsed and gets put onto another queue.
Is it hard to trace where something is, though?
Yes, it's also kind of knowing where the message has got to, what its path of execution was through our different queues and through our sort of processing layers. And if we had any problems, did that message get processed multiple times? Where did things go wrong? But then again, how long did it spend on each queue? How long did it spend being processed by each of our processing layers? Is there anything we can do to fine-tune how long we'll sit and wait before we check to see whether the queue's got any more items on there, to bring the latency of our system down? So one of the guys, Josh Twist, that works on the teams, has written a visualizer that is basically logging out information as items get written onto a queue or as they start to get processed. We get to see information to see that initially this item here is showing that it got written onto the Iridium queue, then jumps over here to show that it got processed, then got passed onto the alarm queue. When it got pulled off the alarm queue, then it's being processed by this dissect message processor that then has a couple of function calls in there, jumps onto the next queue and onto another queue. So we're able to follow how long each message took at different points inside its tracking.
So the size of those bars is the length of time.
Is the length of time, yes.
What's key to this, though, if I don't mind interrupting, is that it's really important that we had to instrument the method in order to be able to record that information, because if we there's no way of actually getting at that data. So we were wrapping each central method method call in the using statement, saying, using this instrumentation, go do this.
Right.
So that data was being written out to an Azure table, which we can then analyse.
But when we want to look at the system as a whole, I mean that the previous one example is fantastic for looking at the flow of a message. We want to see what the system starts to look like as we put more than one message on here. Then we get to see the messages they come through the system as time goes on. But these ones here are showing that there were problems. This message I've never actually reported back to say that it got written onto it had been pulled off the queue and had been dealt with properly. But what we're seeing here is there's an exception being thrown, and this is just test code, hence the silly exception. But this is very easily highlights to us where problems are occurring inside the system, where messages are potentially getting processed more than once, or we're seeing problems.
I mean, particularly, like we said earlier, if you're running 10 or so processes, and multiple instances of the same processes on separate threads in the same process, being able to actually debug that is going to be a hell of a challenge, but providing that kind of level of instrumentation.
This is debugging the messages flowing.
That's right.
The system.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's debugging lines of code.
Exactly. Right. I mean, it's post-mortem kind of inspection of what the system actually did.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, certainly the numbers of volumes of messages we've been talking about doing, I think we were simulating like 2,500 vessels going through the system. There's quite a few messages coming in. Just understanding if all those messages have been processed successfully is, did it work or did it not? There were no exceptions.
I'm just wondering whether it's worth, just for the sake of the audience, to try and explain a little bit about what the process is and what the code is actually doing, because I think that'll help people understand what we had to do. I mean, essentially, if you just think of all the inbound messages coming in from the satellite network, the first thing we have to do is we have to essentially read those messages. Okay, so then those messages then get written into a queue. Okay. Now the reason that we do that front end is because at each point in this application we're trying to make this scalable. So there shouldn't be any single point where if we're flooded with volume, we can't instance more of them. So we just go through in the single case first of all. So what's reading this queue is what we call the message processor. So that's taking messages one or more at a time off the queue. And then what it does, it decides what is the nature of that message. And it will then write that message onto a set of other queues. And I'll explain what they are in a moment. I'll draw it a bit neater. So this queue here is what we call the alarm queue. So if the message that came in was a man overboard, for example, that needs dealing with pretty quickly. The next queue down was what we call the position report queue. So we talked earlier about the visibility for vessel overdue, but we need somewhere to store all these position reports so we then subsequently can look at them and find out whether we've missed any.
One of the interesting things about that is that the alarm queue, as though it appears as though that's kind of the most high priority message, the position queue is where all the traffic comes from.
Yes.
So you'll get maybe one message in the alarm queue every 2 weeks.
We could have millions a day coming in, that one. So
we end up having, we're probably going to have, that's our bigger scalability bottleneck than the alarm queue.
And then the other queue down here was we call the cancel queue. Because what you can do with this system, which you can't do with any of the others, is that if it's a false alarm, and the guy raises the alarm on the boat by mistake for whatever reason, then they can send a cancel message. So we want to process that quite quickly too, because if they started to launch lifeboats and helicopters, it gets expensive. So as soon as we can process that and tell them, no, everybody stand down, this is a false alarm, that's important. So then, these are the standard Azure queues here, and then sitting alongside these things are the processors, which are doing the processing of those messages. So in the case of the alarm queue, it's reading the alarm queue and then writing that information into, and this is the Azure table storage, into one or more tables depending on the nature of the message. So we had, for example, an incident table. So that table is recording boat XYZ, has got a GPS location of this and raised this alarm at this time, gets written in here, it needs attention. Okay. And then we had, what were the other tables? We had an event table.
Yeah, which is just basically a log of all the things that have gone on in the system.
Yeah.
And then there's a position report table.
Yep, that's right. We had the position report table.
And this kind of shows the duplication of the system in the data we're recording, so that if an alarm came in, we'd end up creating an incident. We'd also write an event, and we'd write a position report. But the position report data, so the lat long of the boat, etc., gets written into all of those tables. Mm. And depending on how we actually want to query it, depends which table we go to rather than what join we put together.
So, as I'm watching you draw this, it seems to me that you've got messages coming in that need to be acted upon.
Yeah.
But in the case of position reporting, it's actually the lack of a message coming in that is the thing that triggers something to happen. So how does that work?
I'll let Neil explain that, because he designed that bit, because it's quite complicated. We sat in a meeting room.
I was going to say, about 2 days of design, a day and a half.
arguing how we should do that, because we thought we could do it with queues to start with, and we looked at all different kinds of mechanisms, but we ended up coming up with quite an elegant solution. Well, I say we. or Brainbox here, he came up with the solution.
So what we end up doing is, to enable us to be able to scale, we want to be able to use partitions as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So we basically want a table of all the boats when they last reported in. We don't want to be able to do, when we come to query it, we need to be able to query that against the boat ID, the vessel ID. And we also need to be able to query it against timestamps, so that if you're actually looking for vessels that are overdue. So rather than be able to just query against all the vessels that are at sea, because that's what that table's going to do, so maybe 6,500 fishing vessels, if that's, you're talking about the UK fleet, maybe more if other maritime organisations take the system up. We want to be able to partition the data down. So what we ended up doing was creating effectively a series of partitions based on time buckets. So we worked out a bucket size. I think we worked on 60 seconds, took our date-time object, took the ticks property on that, divided by the number of seconds, well, in that case that works in milliseconds, so the number of milliseconds. Sorry, it works in the number of 100 nanoseconds, excuse me. worked out, or divided by the number, that to generate our bucket ID, and we could then turn that into a string to use that as our partition ID. And what that basically means is we end up with a table, and we've got multiple partitions of that table that are just storing the vessel ID and the time it's the time it last reported. Each of these, its ID becomes its row count, so that's effectively our clustered index on that partition. And we have the partition ID as our bucket, which, as I say, is a calculator of the time when the alarm's due. So what that means is, knowing what time it is now, we can work out which of these buckets are in an alarmed state, and we can just go and raise alarms for all the vessels that are still inside those buckets. So basically what we end up doing with the thread is sitting every so often, we'll wake up, look what time it is, go and have a look to find out how many buckets there are in alarm state, query against all the vessels that are in those, and raise alarms for them.
So each time a message comes in, you actually delete...
Takes it out of the bucket.
A message out of one of those buckets.
So as our position report comes in, we'll pick up the ID of that boat, write it into this alarm, this table. So this again goes back to our reliability piece. We do the write before we do the delete, just in case we fail, and then it's always written down, it's always grounded. We can delete that one, and then we can update the other two tables just to make sure.
And this is all again related to the fact that you really can't query in the same way.
Well,
exactly.
This is the interesting thing I talked earlier about there being no paradigm shift in thinking. This was the only occasion, I think, where we had to do something fundamentally different. In the existing system, this is the simplest part of the whole system, because all you're doing is doing a select star from position report table where I haven't heard from this boat for an hour. That's a simple one-line SQL query, and that's what generates vessel overdue. Here, this was much more complicated because we can't do that query against the table storage.
I mean, we would be able to do that kind of query, but we couldn't partition it. So suddenly that become a massive scalability bottleneck.
Yeah.
So at some point,
you're
going to end up with a query that takes longer.
Yeah, with a million vessels on here, or a million messages a day or something going into this system, that... Even with that capability in the table store, it still wouldn't have been properly scalable.
Yeah, and because it's a calculated bucket ID, we can change the size of those buckets if we run into scalability problems. But at all these points, I mean, we can have multiple queues here if we wanted to. All of these, well, actually, incidents aren't, but all of these are partitioned, so we can scale in all sorts of different directions. All of these processes, we can now instantiate multiple instances of those, and we just gradually chip away.
As you said before, these could either be threads inside a process inside a virtual machine, or they can be
worker processes inside a virtual machine in their own right.
That's right. So we don't think we've ended up with a situation where there isn't any point that system that isn't scalable. And as Neil pointed out, position reports, we just instantiate as many message processes as we need to cope with the volume of inbound messages, and as many processing elements here as we need to deal with it.
Yeah.
The storage is essentially infinite and free, but so that's not a problem. We just keep scaling upwards.
And things you can do here, so at the moment we have one position report queue. There'd be no reason why we couldn't do a round robin on X number of position report queues, and then we've got the processors that are doing a round robin, pulling those items off. You can pull more than one message off at a time, so that we kind of batch things up, because that round trip is obviously relatively expensive by comparison to what we probably do with one of those position reports. So we can pull four or five of them off at a time, or maybe more, and just, well, as I say, chip away at all the bottlenecks. One of the nice things about this kind of keyed architecture is it's really easy to be able to slot things back in again. So as our processor, which is our sort of vessel over due processor, which is running all this piece, checking for the alarm, but if it sees that a vessel is overdue, then it just writes a message into the alarm queue here, and just gets dealt with with our standard processing. Mm-hmm. So again, that bit scales. So if, God forbid, thousands of vessels all went overdue at once, which maybe the satellite network's down rather than some horrific accident in the sea, then we scale that as well.
Mm-hmm. So what next for this? You've got to the point where you have learnt some stuff about the technology. You've found maybe a few patterns and implementations of those patterns that perhaps are generically useful. What's going to happen next? What's going to happen next from AWS's point of view?
I think from a commercial perspective, it's very, very interesting to us because the RNLI and AWS are working together on this, are looking to extend this beyond the shores of the UK, as we talked about at the beginning. But in order to do that, we've got to have a cost-effective mechanism. It might be much harder to go to another search and rescue organisation and say, okay, look, you want to play in this game, that's fine, but you need to fork out $1 million for the infrastructure, because that's what it's going to cost to implement what we have here, for example. And then, you know, the fishermen or the leisure market go off and then buy the kit. But if we could go into them and say, well, actually, you can have this for almost zero capital expenditure, and then as you grow your market in your own country, then we'll just instantiate as much infrastructure as we need to support that. So from a commercial perspective, it's very, very attractive to us. It's an easier sell, which means the take-up is likely to be higher, and also means that we can keep potentially the end-user cost, the fisherman is having to buy the piece of equipment at the end of the day and rent the air time from us, keep that price to an absolute minimum, so that will further drive adoption. So from a commercial perspective, it's very interesting. So we're looking now at formulating some business plans around how we can make that work and what that's likely to cost us to achieve that. I think in the more immediate, short-term future, we'll be looking very carefully at what we've done here and probably fully engineering what we have built in this prototype phase, because obviously you can appreciate we've got to make sure that if we were to launch a system of this sort into the wider community, then it's got to be as reliable and as robust as we currently have. So there would be many weeks and months of testing and trialing of this system. But the very interesting aspect, which we alluded to, Neil alluded to earlier, which is key to this, is that we've got the opportunity here to do that alongside the existing system. So where we've got the existing infrastructure, we're not going to say we're going to switch it off and put it all in the cloud. We're going to run what we have right now and keep that running, because that's saved 5 lives already since January. We're not going to switch that off. But then as we move forward, we take a different approach and we'll say, okay, we'll take the code base, we'll run it in the cloud, run that alongside, prove it that it works in the way we want it to work. And then have the two, and then migrate across. So as the demand increases, well, rather than putting additional servers in our server farm, we'll just instantiate some more processes in the cloud. So that's, I think, it's getting the code into a shape now where we can actually start to do that in a trial basis for real here in the UK. And I expect that we'll be doing that over the next few weeks and months.
And in terms of the code that got written for this,
yeah,
are there any pieces of that that are going to have the potential to be useful?
Yeah, I think some of the small scale stuff around how do you create a timed bucket ID for a partition or a row count based off a timestamp. We would like to kind of release that out. I mean, it's not particularly the most complicated code in the world, but it's nice to see that, just be able to see that stuff's working. We've got some more complicated stuff around. We created a genericized version of a wrapper class that sits on top of the queues, so we've got strongly typed data being written on one of those queues. We're using the XML serializer to be able to serialize those types in and out of a format we can write onto the queues. The stuff that Richard was saying around the fact we
we've got a multi-threaded environment inside our worker process that does feed back into Azure's health monitoring system, so that if any of the threads have problems or any of our processes have problems, that we do end up, we'll retry a couple of times before we feed back to Azure to say, we're in trouble, please create me a new one of me and tear me down. And that kind of stuff we'd like to release. So we're not quite sure about the release mechanism yet. Codeplex sounds like a very attractive option with that. CodeGallery might be another approach, just on the grounds that obviously we won't be releasing a system, we'll just be releasing kind of code snippets or simples, or the simple bits of code.
Yeah. I mean, there's quite a lot of good code samples in the SDK already, particularly wrapping the REST interface in some nice, easy-to-use .NET classes are kind of already there. And we've extended, as Neil said, some of that stuff, so we'd be very happy to share that with the wider community, absolutely.
We just need a little bit more work on that, because, as Richard mentioned, that our code at the moment is scattered with instrumentation to say we're reading stuff on and off keys, etc. If we develop the wrapper classes correctly, then you shouldn't need to do that. All that logging will be wrapped up for you. So yes, we've got a little bit more work to do, and including deciding how to get it out there.
Yeah.
Excellent. So is there anything else we should talk about?
I just want to say that it was just a fantastic experience working in this technology. I'm hugely excited about it, because I think that not only does it satisfy our potential desires for world domination in this particular narrow field, shall we say, there are a whole range of other applications that Azure and the cloud platform more generally is going to have for us as a software company, because I think there are classes of application which need the kind of capability that cloud services can provide, which have previously been out of reach for us, because if you want to process, you know, umpteen terabytes of data in 15 minutes, you've got to provision a whole load of hardware to do that. Most of the time it's going to sit there doing nothing. But with this kind of platform, it's very easy for us to say, okay, well, we now know how to do that, and if we need 10,000 servers for 15 minutes, we can have them. And that makes a big difference. So I think there's lots of other avenues, lots of other opportunities that are going to open up as a result of this experience, but it's been great fun.
Excellent. Great system.
Great use of the Windows Azure technology, and good luck with it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.